News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Here's to Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, here's to your health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, we are going to be talking with Dr. Sid Levinson about colon cancer. And I think lots of our listeners will find lots of pretty surprising and important information, Christy.
I think so, too. I'm looking forward to that conversation.
But very first, let's go into research that matters and stories that matter that are in the news. What's our very first thing that we want to talk about, Christy?
The first one is a commentary about student loans from going to medical school. And this was a commentary in the Wall Street Journal about doctors really struggling to make ends meet because they have such high loans.
Yeah, Christy, you know, when we looked at this, I just thought we need to talk about this because this was about a family physician, actually, who we should be real sympathetic to, who actually ends up with student loans after graduating from medical school and then doing a family practice residency program. She had loans of $250,000, and then it ballooned to $555,000.
It's really a remarkable story, and the summary in the article was an estimation that there was $730 billion in outstanding federal and private student loan debt, much of which, 40% of that debt is actively being repaid. But for a lot of people, they're really driven and affected in their ability to work and pay their loans and pay that debt over time.
Yeah. And, you know, when we looked at this, you know, this is being used to help drive maybe reform of debt to students that take on debt. However, in this particular case, I really was struck by what am I going to say? I don't want to say it's the stupidity, but the stupidity of the physician here who took on knowingly, and she even admits she did it knowingly, all this debt, then deferred it without paying it, then defaulted on it, and then incurred expenses for the defaulting on it, and then did a fellowship even after 3 years of training, which doesn't help her repay, didn't do loan repayment services in areas of need. And, you know, I think this is kind of ridiculous. I think if you're going to take on this much debt, Christy, you really need to and understand it before you did, which she did. She was going to medical school. This wasn't an undergraduate student. You have to accept the responsibility.
Well, I would agree with that. And both of the stories that they tell in here, the doctors said, well, I didn't read the fine print. And so it seems like reading and understanding what you're getting into makes a lot of sense when you're taking on huge loans like this. But, you know, in the bigger picture, aside from that, I do think that, it explains why lots and lots of medical students are graduating with huge debt. And that is a piece of why fewer doctors are choosing primary care, because it's driven partially by their desire to make more money so that they can pay back these huge, especially when you go to a private medical school. You're talking about a lot of money.
Well, and here's the problem. She chose to go to a private medical school. It's $75,000 a year. She could have gone to a public medical school and kept trying until she went to a public medical school. That would have cost her probably over 4 years a total of $75,000. I think you have to live within your means and be realistic, and I don't think she did it.
Well, all right then.
I felt strongly enough about that.
Tell us what you think, Adam. Okay, let's go on to our next research that matters. And this is some research that was published in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine about the difference in both referral rates and in attending counseling for smoking cessation or for alcohol problems, depending on how much or if that counseling program is free.
Yeah, you know, this is really interesting, Christy, because we're in a situation in which we increasingly want to refer those of our patients who have problems with things that could benefit from counseling to people who specialize in counseling. And the question is, if you offer this as a free service, do people refer more often and do they show up more often? And the answer is?
Of course. If it costs, then they're less likely to go.
Well, and I don't think that's necessarily intuitive, because in the past we said, well, let's make it a little costly for them because they won't value it if it's free. But I think this research shows that, and I was struck by the numbers.
Yeah, it really was impressive. So this was for, weight loss or smoking cessation counseling. They found that compared to when it was free, once there was cost associated with that clinicians offered referrals to 79% fewer patients. And then once a referral was offered, 81% fewer patients accepted that referral.
Yeah, so this suggests that, you know, we really need to, in healthcare reform efforts, focus on making counseling benefits a covered option for people. And that not only will it lead to more people obviously going to referral, it'll lead to doctors like us referring our patients more often. It's a win-win-win. It'll reduce costs in the long term.
Yep. Okay.
Well, what's our next research that matters?
Okay. Our next research that matters is a study in the Archives of Internal Medicine about anxiety and exercise training. So we know anxiety is untreated among patients, particularly who have a chronic illness. And we also know that exercise training can help improve anxiety symptoms in these patients.
Yeah. You know, this was very interesting because they looked at over articles that looked at this sort of impact of exercise training on anxiety over, almost 3,000 patients. And they really found that there was a significant protective effect across multiple studies where compared to those who don't go into an exercise training program, those who do really have 30%, at least 30% less anxiety than those who did not have this program.
Yeah, I mean, I love the fact that we're talking about exercise. We're not talking about expensive drugs. We're not talking about, you know, things that we're talking about something that has such a huge health benefit to heart disease and lots of other medical conditions as well. And so I was very encouraged to hear that exercise training can make an improvement in those anxiety symptoms in patients who have chronic illness to that degree. We're not talking about just a little bit, but 30% less symptoms. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, you know, I had a patient the other day, Christy, who was having anxiety and a young man. And, you know, we talked about that. He said, maybe I should start exercising more. And I said, yes, that's a good thing, but we also have to deal with some of the underlying issues as to about the anxiety. And I think in retrospect, I really should have said, yes, let's do focus on the exercise.
Right.
Because, you know, you want to do that. This will have a beneficial impact. And it's not either or, it's both.
Absolutely. It's one piece of the whole treatment picture, but it's an important one.
And probably just as powerful as some of the pills we give.
Yeah.
Well, our very last research that matters actually is on something that we talked about with a recent guest about cancer. And a recent guest, we talked about sexuality, but this time it's about sexuality among patients with cancer.
So this was a study looking in the Journal of Sexual Medicine, looking at the risks of sexual problems among people who have cancer and trying to tease out recommendations concerning prevention of those sexual problems and optimal treatments.
Yeah, and not really unsurprisingly, the diagnosis of cancer as well as the treatment of cancer has both direct and indirect effects on the way people experience their disease, they experience sexuality, and it impacts on relationships and on psychological as well as physical aspects. It's pervasive.
And the other thing they found was that the sexual problems that might be associated would depend on a person's sexual health and function prior to that diagnosis of cancer, their response to receiving that diagnosis, what kind of support they have, specific treatments that might be involved in the cancer, and then whether or not there was any proactive counseling in their healthcare conversations with their doctors and any efforts to make those better.
Yeah, you know, so Christy, the bottom line is what do we do with this information? And I think one of the things that I know that I could do better is have conversations. You know, I have lots of patients that are diagnosed with prostate cancer and breast cancer, you know, every year. And I'm thinking, okay, do I have the conversation at the time of the diagnosis or shortly thereafter about what is sexual life like for you now and how that's going to change and open up that conversation because it may get worse and likely will get worse with treatment.
Well, and I think we both agree that sexual health is an important piece of your overall health. And so when now we know that the people with a new diagnosis of cancer are at higher risk for having those problems, we should start that conversation. It really is about opening the door to work it through for a patient.
Yeah, well, I think we will be more likely to have those conversations now. And You know, I think, Christy, as we begin to transition out of research that matters, there are some important things that we actually have been able to talk about today.
I would agree. We've talked a little bit about sexual health, a bit about exercise and the importance of exercise in reducing anxiety symptoms.
The importance of really being able to refer patients without patients really having to pay for it, for just common health behavior counseling. And finally, the ridiculous nature of people taking on too great of student loans, particularly if they're going into medicine.
Yep. That concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Sid Levinson about colon cancer. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Here's to Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking about a colon cancer. And just to set the stage, you know, colon cancer, and the reason Christy and I really wanted to talk about this is, we think it's one of those types of cancers in the U.S. that doesn't get enough due, perhaps, that people don't realize just how important it is in terms of a cause of cancer and how important it is in terms of our ability to potentially prevent a large majority of these cancers. We saw in 2005 data that says over 72,000 men and almost 70,000 women were diagnosed with colorectal cancer. And over 50,000 men and women died from colorectal cancer, making it, again, one of the top causes of cancer, and really something that most people maybe don't appreciate.
Yeah, I would agree with all of that, Adam. And we're glad to have this conversation today. We'd like to welcome Dr. Sid Levinson, who is a professor of medicine at UNC and the medical director of the UNC Hospital's Endoscopy Center at Meadowmont. A graduate of Cornell University Medical College, Dr. Levinson trained at New York Hospital and did his GI training at UNC. His main interests are in outpatient and endoscopic services, and he has a particular interest in colorectal cancer screening. So we're glad to have you with us today, Dr. Levinson.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
You know, one of the things we like to frequently help our listeners understand, and Christy and I, is, you know, how did you, as a general internist, get really interested in colorectal cancer?
Well, actually, I started out my career as a gastroenterologist, but I was also in internal medicine. So my first 25 years as a practicing physician, I did both gastroenterology, both consultative and primary, and also did some primary care. But I was always interested in gastroenterology from the time I was a third-year medical student.
What pushed you in that direction?
Well, the people that I worked with, the attendings at New York Hospital, I also was fortunate enough to be at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, which is a part of my training program, and I worked with some of the real special people who started a lot of the work in colonoscopy and in colorectal cancer screening, even before it was accepted as a process to prevent the development of colon cancer.
Well, we're glad that that you have found a passion in this area. It's something, you know, talking about colon cancer screening is something that Adam and I do on a daily basis with our patients to try to make sure they're up to date on colon cancer screening and try to have a conversation about, you know, if there's any resistance to having a colonoscopy done. And since this is your area of expertise, I'd wonder if you'd speak to what we know about the effectiveness of colonoscopies as a means of screening and preventing colon cancer.
Sure. I'm glad to do that. First of all, the statistics that Adam commented on just at the beginning of our segment here are the more recent cancer statistics. When we opened up the endoscopy center at Meadowmont in January of 2005, we had on our website, which is actually still there, a picture of Keenan Stadium, which showed that in this coming year, approximately 60,000 people in America will die of colon cancer. Well, it turns out that that was, of course, based on the statistics that were a few years prior. There were also 160,000 people being diagnosed every year. So I personally think that we have really good evidence that screening colonoscopies are actually having an impact, because the more recent cancer statistics suggest that 50,000 people a year died from colorectal cancer, and there were 140,000 to 150,000 newly diagnosed cases. So if you institute a program where people routinely, for preventive health care, get their colons checked, and we remove precancerous polyps, we really think we can make an impact on that. And I think the statistics actually show that now, which is pretty exciting.
Well, you know, when I was coming through medical school and training, this was a little bit controversial at some elements. We believed in doing colon cancer screening, but there was this time in which, and I know you're intimately familiar with this, where we believed, well, you could do hemocults and, you know, take some stool and check for blood. And if there wasn't blood, you could be reassured you weren't going to have cancer. Or you could do the sigmoidoscopy, which looked at kind of maybe two-thirds of the colon, but not the whole colon, and optimistically.
That's a pretty impressive sigmoidoscopy.
Well, they do it more aggressively. but then it appeared to be a real shift maybe 5 or 10 years ago. What led to this shift? And do you or do doctors, because I don't come across that much, still recommend either hemocult testing or sigmoidoscopy?
Well, some doctors still do, but you're speaking to a gastroenterologist who has been doing colonoscopies for over 30 years, and I am the medical director of the UNC Hospital's Endoscopy Center, where we do screening colonoscopies and diagnostic studies, as well as other types of GI procedures on a daily basis. So, first of all, with regards to the approach as to why we do screening colonoscopies now instead of the other procedures, the best study probably was the VA study that came out by now 5, 6, 7 years ago, where it looked at 3,000 patients, and the statistics came out very clearly in favor of doing screening colonoscopies for anyone over the age of 50. Once you started screening for precancerous polyps and for cancers that hadn't really developed significant symptoms, the breakpoint seemed to be at the age of 50, that if you did screening colonoscopies on the general population, you would actually start the reduction of the benign adenoma to colon cancer progression. In other words, most colon cancers, though not all of them, will start as a benign polyp. And so my job, and the job of all of my colleagues, both at UNC and anywhere else where these procedures are done, is to find polyps at an early stage, particularly the type that we call adenomas, which are the gland-forming precancerous type of polyps. And if we find adenomas at an early stage and we remove them, we feel like we're actually doing something. And this happens every day in our job. There are some days where we find much more significant polyps. There has been a report, for example, in the last few years about flat polyps in the right side of the colon. Well, that is interesting and, to us, not really new news, because we've been finding flat polyps for years and knowing how significant they were. Those are polyps that you can't find really without a colonoscopy, which gets me back to your point about hemocults and flexible sigmoidoscopy, and you left out barium enema, which is the third cog of that triangle. There are some physicians...
An X-ray that shoots dye up into the rectum, and it's as messy as it sounds at some level.
And uncomfortable. Being pumped full of air is nobody's great treat. And what we do, usually, I would say 95% of our patients are sedated, so they are much more comfortable than anybody getting a barium enema.
Well, you know, it's a beautiful concept that, although most people wouldn't say the colonoscopy itself is a beautiful thing, just thinking that a colonoscopy where you can see a lesion or a polyp before it becomes cancer and then take it off before it ever becomes cancer, it just makes so much sense. I know the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force suggests we do colon cancer screening, and that the other alternatives of fecal occult blood testing or the... or flexible sigmoidoscopy could be acceptable alternatives. My practice is to encourage the colonoscopy, but for patients who really, really, really don't do it, some conversation about the other alternatives is better than nothing. Is that your take on it as well?
Well, any screening is better than nothing. I think that the thing I worry about the most is that people who have hemocults that are negative and a flexible sigmoidoscopy performed even by people who know what they're doing to 60 centimeters of the colon really gets you up beyond the sigmoid colon, perhaps to the descending colon, but that's really no more than a third of the colon. We know that the disease tends to be migrating, meaning we're finding, and in fact it may be because we're finding them, but it seems as though there are more right-sided polyps and colon cancers these days than there used to be when I was an intern and a resident, and I was taught that 75 to 80% of all colon polyps and cancers were reachable with a rigid sigmoidoscope. And we won't get into that one because there's a lot of folks out there who remember the rigid sigmoidoscope, the silver bullet as it was called. And most of our young physicians don't even know what a sigmoidoscope looks like. But with the advent of flexible sigmoidoscopy and flexible instruments, flexible fiber optic instruments, we can do whatever we need to do comfortably and safely. And that's really what we need to do.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break, but I know we're going to come back and extend this conversation. And I guess the analogy might be if we're doing a screening for skin cancer, what if we looked on your whole body but not your back? And I hadn't really thought about that until I heard you talking about that, Dr.
Like
Levinson.
That.
And
I
think that creates some really interesting question for us. But we will take a short break. When we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Sid Levinson, about colon cancer. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Here's to Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Sid Levinson about colon cancer screening and having a real nice conversation about the value of colonoscopies for screening for colon cancer. And one of the conversations I'd really like to have is about overcoming barriers to getting colon cancer screening.
Sure.
So access, how do people pay for it if they don't have insurance, fear, preparation, what do we know about how to overcome those barriers?
Well, one of the things that I think is really important to those of us who do these procedures, and frankly to all physicians, is that we really believe that we're having an impact on the incidence of colorectal cancer by doing screening colonoscopies. And so how can we make sure people do the procedure with greater efficacy and also without being afraid of it? Everybody has a story that they heard about from some friend somewhere who had a terrible experience, either with the prep or with the procedure itself. Now, if you talk to most people who've had the procedure, the benefits of the procedure compared with the discomfort are, the benefits vastly outweigh the problems with the procedure.
Is that something that the provider then? I mean, you know, I sometimes think that I have more of a concern that it'll be uncomfortable for my patients, but I, like you just said, my patients frequently say, well, I was knocked out. It was great.
In good hands, a colonoscopy should not be a significant issue. Certainly, most of the time, what I hear from patients is the prep was the worst part of it. And when we're done with the procedure, they ask us, when are we going to begin? And so that, in those situations, we know.
That's a good sign.
It is. It's a good sign.
But they remember the preparation.
Well, sure. I remember the prep. I've been through a colonoscopy twice so far in my life, and I remember the prep. I can tell you that I had the cherry prep once, and I will never drink a cherry beverage again in my life. But nonetheless, it helped me have a really good colonoscopy, and it was well worth doing. We're trying to get patients to the point where this won't be a big issue. This is health maintenance. I keep underscoring that. This is health maintenance. When people are getting their blood pressures checked or their sugars checked, those are diseases, diabetes, for example, or congestive heart failure if you develop it from severe hypertension over the years, you do something about it. You treat
the
blood pressure.
So if you have it done at age 50, have it done at age 50 as a screening, what's your recommendation, assuming there's no underlying adenomas found, and there's no high risk in the family. How often do you recommend it? And at what age do you recommend that people stop getting colonoscopies?
I've answered both of those questions several times today to patients. So,
okay, I'm glad you didn't say to us because
we weren't listening to you.
Okay. Well, but, you know, we're all people. So someday you'll be drinking the PrEP too, you know.
Sooner rather than later, unfortunately.
That's right. So if you have no family history of colorectal cancer or adenomas, multiple adenomas or precancerous polyps in the family is a risk factor for colon cancer. If you have no brothers or sisters or parents, then who are considered primary relatives, then, or first degree, really, then you should be having a colonoscopy every 10 years. So if you have a negative exam, no family history, no other risk factors like ulcerative colitis or previous radiation treatments to the pelvis, for example, then you can wait a full 10 years if you've had a good colonoscopy, which is one of the reasons you want to do a good PrEP, because if we don't see everything, it's not really right for us to tell you we saw everything, and so you can wait 10 years.
And since this is a critical piece of health maintenance, as you say, how do people who don't have insurance or don't have insurance that will pay for it, how do they get a colonoscopy?
It's different, I'm sure, in all systems, in private offices and in universities. Most insurance programs, for example, Medicare, was the first to actually pay for screening colonoscopies, one of the great things that Medicare did in the last 10 or 15 years. And so patients over the age of 65 don't usually have an issue with that. In this state, there is actually a law that says that insurance companies must pay for screening colonoscopies. Now, the intervals are what needs to be clarified how long in between the procedures. If people have absolutely no insurance and wish to be involved in their own health care, then, for example, at UNC hospitals, certainly we can always arrange for payment programs if patients are still paying for their own health needs. Nobody should not have the procedure because they can't come up with a certain amount of money right up front. This can always be something that can be paid out, or certainly our financial counselors are involved every day with patients trying to figure out how they can help them get the care they need.
That's great to know.
And if we had the colonoscopy at age 50 for 3 months for me and 3 months, and then age 60, 70, I assume if you're healthy otherwise, you would get one at age 82. Is that when you would stop, or when would you stop?
Well, that's the conversation I was telling you I had today with a patient who was 81. If you have had previous polyps and we're going to be following you up every 5 years, for example, and the patient is healthy, so I tell patients, see you in 5 years. And then when they ask me that question, my response is, we stop doing a colonoscopy as a preventive measure when the likelihood of the patient's surviving long enough for a colorectal cancer to develop is unlikely to occur. For example, if you have some sort of bad heart disease and you're unlikely to survive 5 years, well, then you don't need to have a colonoscopy. But these days, people are living longer and living better and living healthier. So it's not...
So you're doing more colonoscopies.
Oh,
and
yes.
If everyone were to start getting colonoscopies according to the schedule, when it was all insured, we would have some difficulties perhaps getting people in for colonoscopies when there wouldn't be enough trained providers.
Well, I think there's a chance that will happen, and manpower issues are certainly something that we and the GI societies, the gastrointestinal societies, are certainly concerned about. Right now, I think it's safe to say that any patient who wishes to present themselves for a colonoscopy can get that exam. We haven't gotten to the point where we've outstripped our supply.
Aside from screening colonoscopy, what should we advise patients, and what can you tell our listeners of strategies with their diet or with their health to prevent colon cancer?
Well, I wish I had more information than I do about that, but we have some good information. There is a famous nurses study out of Harvard that looked at lots of things. And one of the things that this study looked at, I think it was 90,000 individuals. And this study demonstrated that people who ate one steak a week had more colon cancer than people who ate one steak a month than, and those folks had more colon cancer than people who didn't eat steaks. And so it's fairly clear that red meats and animal fats, and that of course includes very fatty dairy foods as well, because that's an animal fat. Diets high in red meats and animal fats actually increase the risk of colorectal cancer. We here at UNC and in many other universities have been involved in a variety of studies looking for what might be effective prevention or chemo prevention, for example. If you take calcium, either in the form of a pill or in your diet, you are likely to decrease the amount of the number of polyps that you develop by, in some studies, up to 30%.
And what about aspirin?
Well, that's a plus-minus study. There's the big aspirin study, of which we were a part of at UNC, showed that in a select population, which was actually women over the age of 50, a baby aspirin did decrease the incidence of polyps, but only about 10%. And so in the GI community, whether or not to take aspirin as chemo prevention is always up for discussion, because you have to balance the risks of being on a regular aspirin, for example, the risks of bleeding ulcer disease versus the benefits. In terms of diet, I'd love to tell you that we've demonstrated that a high fiber, high vegetable diet clearly decreases colorectal cancer. We do know that people who eat more fruits and vegetables have less colon cancer. But in terms of fiber, just fiber itself, that has not been demonstrated to be preventative.
Well, I think we're going to have to, unfortunately, put a bookmark in our conversation, but this has been really a fascinating conversation about really where we're at and really where we've come from. It is a story. It's a narrative. And I really, and Christy and I really appreciate Dr. Levinson, you coming here and sharing your narrative. I think you probably have done more colonoscopies than perhaps any provider in this region in the last two decades. And you probably know people's insides and outsides better than anyone. And I know patients really want to come see you year after year. And that says a lot about you and your care at UNC. So thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Coming up on House Calls, we're going to be answering questions about your health. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Here's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Here's to your health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Here's to Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Here's to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we'll spend a few minutes talking about your health questions, experiences, and attitudes towards medical care.
We want you to write us about your experiences and your questions. You can send them to us at yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Julie Steiner, to read us what are the House Call questions we have today. Julie.
Dear Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page, you hear about chest pain and heart attacks all the time, urging people to go to the emergency room. How do I know when chest pain is serious? Emergency rooms have such long waits. There must be a way to know if chest pain is heart-related or not. Thanks so much for your opinions.
Well, that's a great, great question. And really insightful that, you know, we have pains in our chest region for a whole variety of reasons, most of which aren't scary. But trying to tease out from your perspective as the patient, when is that chest pain significant enough that I need to go to the emergency room is a really important question.
You know, and it's not necessarily a whole lot easier for people like Christy and I with lots of medical experience as it is for a family member. I recall a couple of years ago, Christy, when I was with my mother here visiting, and you know she had a plane to catch, and we were kind of getting ready to go to take her to the airport, and she got some discomfort in her chest, and we were really trying to figure out, well, does she need to go to the emergency room? Because we know, Christy, if we take her to the emergency room, that's a 24-hour admission, at least, and it's going to trigger all kinds of tests. And so we sat outside the emergency room for about an hour because I thought it might be heartburn, but I said, you know, if you're worried about it, we should go get this looked at. And then also give me a little more time to figure out if I'm worried about it too.
Sure. Well, I think, you know, this is a bigger topic than we can cover really in a few minutes on in response to your question. But I do think the first thing to do is talk to your doctor about your risk. Think about with your doctor, do you have risk risk factors for heart disease, like smoking, your age? Do you have other medical problems like diabetes, hypertension, or cholesterol? Do you have people in your family who have died from early heart attacks or heart attacks before age 55? And do you yourself already have heart disease? Those are things that would increase your risk that if you're having chest pains, that you really do need to think about that.
Yeah, and you know, and even if you know these things, if you get chest pain and it's beneath your sternum and it's unlike any pain you've ever had before and you have some of the other symptoms, and we talked about this for women and how women don't come in and get checked out soon enough and often enough, you know, it's okay to come in and get checked out. It's okay to call your doctor or your provider or the nurse and ask if you should come in and be seen. You know, don't feel bad, because we'd much rather you come in and be seen than to sit there and perhaps have a heart attack and not be seen.
Absolutely. And the best scenario is you come in and your doctor or the emergency room doctor can reassure you. Maybe it's something more simple. We hope that it is. But to err on the side of caution makes sense.
Well, Julie, what's our next house call?
My wife has been ill for many months now after her stroke last year left her paralyzed and unable to communicate. She's been in the hospital 5 times for pneumonia, dehydration, and infections. I feel bad because I have a really hard time caring for her. She's getting sicker, and she cannot tell me what she really wants to do. She is eating less and less, and I am thinking about if I need or should ask her doctors to put in a feeding tube. What is your opinion?
Well, wow, that's a really difficult question. And maybe, Christy, you and I can talk about this for a little bit, because there's a lot of issues here. And maybe if we take just a couple extra minutes on this particular one, we can address some of them.
Yeah, it's so hard when you're caring for someone who can't talk and express her concerns. And
she's getting sicker at the same time.
Right.
With 5 hospital admissions, it suggests that, you know, it's possible that she's what we would a lot of times say is dying. And we're not experts at saying when someone is dying, but, and you might say, well, we're all dying at some point in time. But, you know, she suggests that there's a lot going on that really makes her getting sicker and sicker.
Right. There may be previous conversations in your relationship with her that could guide you. But in terms of my take on feeding tubes and in the setting of someone who really has a steady decline like this, you know, there's some data out there showing that it doesn't necessarily prolong life. And now may be the time to start thinking really about quality of life for her. And even talking with your primary doctor about something we're going to talk about soon in an upcoming show, about palliative care, or thinking about potentially hospice or using resources to help her be more comfortable.
Yeah, and it makes it even more difficult, because, you know, you might, when you say what is your opinion, we assume that you're really talking about the feeding tube, but maybe you're really talking about a broader, these things that Christy's starting to ask about, you know, what is our opinion about her quality of life? And unfortunately, we can't say what the quality of life is for anyone. And actually, you know, the research that says even spouses saying what the quality of life of their loved ones is not very good literature. And so, you know, it may be that quality of life for your spouse is, you know, it's almost infinite, that being alive and having some value, particularly if she recognizes, maybe has quality. On the other hand, some people would say, my life doesn't have much quality there. So I think it's going to require a longer conversation with your primary care provider over a longer period of time to help start getting into some of those questions.
I also think that as a whole, we don't involve hospice soon enough. And so sometimes people think if you're talking about that, that means for sure that they're actively dying. But in this setting, it may be helpful to ask your doctor for a consultation, or would that be appropriate to have a consultation with the hospice team to see, you know, are there people who can, other resources that can help support you and help guide you as you make these very difficult decisions as you care for your wife?
Yeah, hospice doesn't mean do nothing.
Right.
It means maybe provide lots of support, because you may think, well, maybe they are dying in the 6 months. But then 6 months later, if they're wrong, well, okay, then you may
that's
pull
great.
Back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, well, that's probably all we can do about that question. We have one last question. Julie?
I went to my doctor yesterday after feeling bad with a cough, hoarse throat, and aching all over. It hit me hard the day before my doctor visit. I didn't have a fever, but I felt warm. I asked her for an antibiotic to help me feel better, but she thought it was a virus that wouldn't get better with an antibiotic. I started getting more hoarse throughout the day, and I called the nurse the next day to get an antibiotic called into my pharmacy, but the doctor advised me to return for another visit. Why won't doctors just give us what we know our body needs?
Wow. That's a loaded question.
Well, you know, that's I'm not sure I agree with the premise here. I have to be frank, Christy, and I, you know, that there's a difficult one here that, you know, patients always know what they need, and I think they know what they need in terms of feeling better, but this is a conversation. It's not a unidirectional conversation either.
Right. In either direction, either the patient
yes,
demanding
correct.
What they know they need or the doctor, you know, not listening to the patient or just arguing their one point of view.
How do you have the conversation, Christy? And then I'll tell you how I have the conversation. Let's compare.
Well, I usually have a conversation about antibiotics in the setting of a virus because, you know, an antibiotic is geared towards fighting bacteria. And when it's a virus, the antibiotic doesn't do anything except for put you at risk for major side effects from that, like yeast infections or diarrhea. There are reactions people have to antibiotics that can be harmful.
Yeah, we had a patient in the hospital recently had one dose of an antibiotic and their entire skin sloughed and they were on a respirator.
It's awful.
That's what people don't see. And I oftentimes say on the other end of it that, you know, we could be wrong and it could be end up being bacterial, but most authorities recommend waiting for 5 to 7 days to see if your body does recuperate and what things can you do to boost your own immune system.
Right. And so, I mean, those are the kinds of conversations. It's not like, oh, you don't need an antibiotic and that's the end of the conversation. But then what else can you do to help with fluids and with other medicines like Tylenol or Motrin to help fight off a fever?
Because this listener really does want to feel better and we want to help them feel better.
Mm-hmm. So coming back to the doctor to have a second conversation actually might be really a worthwhile evaluation and discussion.
Yeah. Last thing that some doctors will do, and we don't have time to get into it, but sometimes they will write a prescription and say, if you're not better in 5 days, then maybe can start it. And this sometimes for some patients may work. But again, we don't have time to get into that in more detail today.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope you're feeling better. We've had a chance now to talk a little bit about chest pain and heart attacks, a little bit about decisions about when your loved one can't communicate with you and you're having to make decisions about that.
And finally, how to negotiate maybe a conversation with your provider about the need for antibiotics or even any other treatments that you want.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for joining us today for Here's to Your Health. We hope we've addressed some issues that are important to you and your health, and we want you to email us at yourhealth@unc.edu. That's yourhealth@unc.edu, and you can follow us on Twitter as well.
And we'd like to thank the staff at WCHL, UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our producer, Julie Steiner, and our great guest today, Dr. Sid Levinson. We hope you'll join us next time on Here's to Your Health.
On behalf of the UNC Department of Family Medicine, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. We'll see you again next week. Bye-bye.
Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Here's to Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website at 1360WCHL.com and click on WCHL On Demand. Here's to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine at News Talk 1360 WCHL.